Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren. Mr. Eric Shapiro, the COVID king, is here.
Yeah, you know, I'm more throaty today than I was last time, but I'm powering through.
Well, you're a champ, you know.
But you thank you so much. Thank you.
You got to stay out of those wicked places you're going to. All these circuit parties.
Yeah, I know.
Parties,
no. You know?
My
you're
God,
you're setting me up to make some controversial jokes.
I am. I you yeah, you know how I work. well, anyway, so we've got a great guest here. It's been quite a week. So let's just bring him in and talk to him. I want to find out. So, Mr. S.A. Cosby, thank you for being on the show.
I thank you guys for having me.
Yeah. So Sean, I'm really interested now. So you all of a sudden broke out just a couple of years ago, become like real famous and have been doing really well. So tell me, what's the secret? So how do I get there? I should be doing what you're doing. I want to know. Yeah. So you got to tell me how do I become a really good writer like this?
What you have to do is get rejected about 75 to 100 times, then use that spite to drive your desire to be a superstar. No, I'm kidding. I have no idea.
Wait a second. So you've written three novels, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the most recent one is Razorblade Tears, preceded by Blacktop Wasteland. And what was the first one?
My Darkest Prayer.
Was My Darkest Prayer as successful as the subsequent two?
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay.
But it was a really great sort of entry it was a really great ticket, I guess, sort of into the world of crime fiction. It was published by an independent publisher, Entry Publications out of DC. So big up to my boy Austin Camacho and his wife Denise. They're that company. And it was a book that was picked up after I gotten dropped by an agent. And it sort of was a way, it started my journey in crime fiction.
So, and then Blacktop Wasteland comes out. And I've been your Facebook friend for a couple of years. And I was seeing one after the other just winning all these awards. It was getting to the point where if I needed a pick-me-up or an inspiration, all I'd have to do is go to your page, because on any given day you'd be popping off with like fantastic news. So I know that book exploded. So tell me about what happened with Blacktop Wasteland and what went differently in terms of the commercial performance.
Okay, so here's the story of Blacktop Wasteland. So My Darkest Prayer was coming out. And, again, it was with an independent publisher. So a lot of times when you're working with folks like that, they do the best they can. And then you have to do a lot of work as well. And so it's sort of a punk rock ethos, you know. And anyway, I was going to BoucherCon, which is this huge mystery convention that takes place in different parts of the country, takes place in different parts of the world. And it was going to be in St. Petersburg, Florida that year. Anyway, I hadn't had a great year up to that point. Even though I had gotten my book picked up, I had, like I said, been dropped by an agent. And, I was with the great folks at Entry. But, you know, it's hard. It's rough when you're an independent writer. Bookstores aren't that gracious, to be honest with you. And so it's hard to get traction. It's hard to get attention. So I saved all my pennies, and I was going to go to BoucherCon. I had a backpack full of advanced copies of Darkest Prayer, and I was just going to hand them out to people. So anyway, what happened was about 2 weeks before that convention, it's so funny. I heard an interview with Bruce Springsteen where he talked about when he wrote Born to Run and how he had these two flops for his record company. And so when he wrote Born to Run, he stopped trying to write a hit record and he just wrote what he liked, the themes and the motifs that he enjoyed. And I sat down and I said, that's what I'm going to do with Blacktop Wasteland. And I finished it, but I didn't know what to do with it. And so when I got anyway, so fast forward, I go to convention. A buddy of mine named Eric Pruitt is the moderator for a panel on Southern crime fiction. And they need one more person. And he asked me to be on that panel. And I was on that panel with some great writers like Ace Atkins and Alex Segura and Steph Post. And we had a great time talking about Southern crime fiction, you know, the holy trinity of Southern crime fiction, which is sex, class, and race. I think you could throw religion in there for a quartet. But anyway, there was this lady who, after we finished talking, she got up and she said, I don't really have a question, I have a comment. And I'll never forget Ace Atkins, who's like 6'4", built like a brick house. He nudges me in the arm. Here we go. And so this lady basically got up and wanted to complain about us talking about how bad slavery was. And, and so to kind of diffuse the situation, I made a joke. I said, look, I know it's difficult for you. You feel like you're being put upon. You feel like you're going to be a minority soon. I said, I'm going to help you through that. Me and you are going to work through this together. I'm going to teach you how to drive while black and, you know, get accosted in jewelry stores and stuff. And right. Everybody laughed and kind of eased the tension in the room. And afterwards, a guy comes up to me, this little studious looking gentleman. He's like, hey, my name is Josh Kessler, and I'm a literary agent. I like to work with you. And that's how Blacktop Wasteland. That's what happened. And then he took me on as a client in November of 2018. He sold it to Flatiron Books in February of 2019, and it changed my life. It changed everything.
And then backing up to earlier in the story, you said you had lost an agent after the publication or surrounding the publication of your first book. And I think our listeners will be curious as to why that happened and what happened.
Okay, so I'm not going to say who the agent was.
Oh, come on, give us a
very
name.
Nice person. And we did, I'm a gentleman and a scholar. But we parted ways. It was amicable. There was no animosity. But getting an agent is sometimes like getting into a relationship. You know, when you're first with that person, you're in the full flush of lust, so to speak.
Yeah.
But then sometimes you realize, hey, we don't fit. This isn't working. And so for me and this agent, it just wasn't working. And you know, he had Darkest Prayer. He just couldn't seem to sell it. So after about a year and a half, I said, hey, let me try to write something else. And in the meantime, I'm going to take Darkest Prayer off your hands. And he was like, all right. He said, well, let me know when you got something else. And we kind of just parted ways, you know. And after that, I met Austin and Denise Camacho at a live reading in D.C., in Washington, D.C., put on by my friend Ed Amar. And they have a publishing house. They took it on, and like I said, it was an independent publisher. But we sold quite a few copies, and it just re-certified my belief in myself. It made me bet on myself. Always trust your own gut instincts, because in this thing, whether it's writing, whatever creative endeavor you have, no one knows your art better than you do, and you have to trust yourself. Now, I'll give you an example of what I mean. So when me and his agent got together talking about the book, The original title is My Darkest Prayer. And he's like, oh, I hate it. I hate that title. It's not going to sell anything. The first line of My Darkest Prayer, because it's in first person, is the character Nathan Waymaker saying, I handle the bodies, because he works at a funeral home part-time. And he's a part-time private eye, or unlicensed private eye. And so the agent was like, oh, that should be the name. I handle the bodies. And I'm like, oh, my goodness. That's a terrible name. That's an awful name. But because I didn't know anything about the business, I kind of just shut up. And I'm like, all right. And nobody wanted it. Yeah. No one wanted it. And so I came away from that relationship understanding two things, that, you know, you got to trust yourself. You got to speak up for yourself. You got to be your own best advocate. And again, that is not to demonize or denigrate that guy. He, you know, very nice dude. Years later, when I won a bunch of awards, he was very gracious and sent me a bottle of really good bourbon. So, you know, it just sometimes doesn't work out with people, but you always got to believe and bet on yourself.
Yeah.
Because again, you're the one that's going to, make it happen for you. So nobody's going to ever fight as hard for you as you fight for yourself.
And this earlier agent, this individual was somebody that was strong, maybe not as strong as your subsequent agent, but this, he was able to make it work with other people. But in your case, the chemistry and the timing was just not there.
Yeah. And this is, and again, this person is a very reputable agent in the industry, has had some really famous clients. But, you know, like you said, the chemistry just wasn't there. We just weren't clicking. And again, no animosity toward that person. Like I said, again, he's been super gracious ever since. We ran into each other at a convention, and he was very nice. And, you know, he said, I just wish I could have made it work because I knew you had talent. And, you know, and sometimes it doesn't work out. You know, I think you don't need to burn bridges, but you definitely need sometimes to walk away.
Yeah. How do you deal with all the noise, but? Because now all of a sudden it's, you know, the big blow up, and then so you're being watched, so to speak, and you're being talked about, and people are, well, you know how it is. You know, you kind of get it. Yeah. I've dealt with this, and I deal with it now. But when it's sudden, as a writer, how do you focus on what your project is now and what you're doing today rather than all of this other stuff?
It's tough, because I think especially – I went from working like 60 hours a week at a hardware store to seeing my books like on the Today Show. And previous to that, I've been writing all my life. You know, I've been sending out stories way back when, since, you know, you had to send a self-addressed stamp envelope to get them back. So that's how old I am. But, everything seems to happen overnight, but it didn't, you know. So I keep myself grounded. I don't, you know, take myself too seriously. If you follow me on social media, I'm pretty self-deprecating. But I think you have to sort of focus on the writing itself, but also separate those things. I wasn't always able to do that, especially before things really took off. I was very consumed by writing, and I didn't take time to enjoy life. You know, I used to beat myself up if I didn't write every single day, because, you know, God bless him, Stephen King said he wrote every single day. So I got to do that. And, you know, I learned from me, you know, that may work for him, but what works for me is maybe taking a day off during the week, you know, kind of recharging the batteries, going for a hike. I live in rural Virginia, and I love hiking nature trails. And then sometimes I like just doing, you know, wild hikes on my own, just walking through the woods. Before the pandemic, I was really in the gym. I need to get back in the gym. I've put on the COVID-25. But I think for me, taking time out to enjoy things, you know, seeing a movie or sitting down and just, you know, meditating, or just going somewhere with some friends. We recently just got back from a little retreat in North Carolina. And, you know, it recharges your batteries. It gets you. For me, it gets me pumped to come back to work on a project. But I will say this, after Razorblade Tears and everything that happened with that, which exceeded my wildest expectations, it was hard to start a new project. You know, it felt like there's a quote from Game of Thrones, the TV show, that always sticks in my head now. And there's a character who's a king on there. He says, I was never so alive as when I was winning this throne, and never so dead as when I sat upon it. And I don't feel exactly like that, but there is this sort of hunger when you're trying to, as the kids say, get on, you know? And when you get on, sometimes you feel like, am I a fraud? you know, and then you feel like maybe the project that I'm working on, it has to be exactly as good as the project I did before, or, you know, it's a failure, and you've got to kind of put that out of your mind. I had a good friend of mine told me, he was like, hey, man, this project you're working on now, it doesn't have to be as good as Raised by Tears. It just got to be good. And I think that's something I'll always remember, because I think that's something that helps you kind of shuff off the expectations. When I wrote Blacktop Wasteland, I had no expectations. Nobody knew who I was. As my grandmother would say, nobody would have spit on me if I was on fire. and so I had no pressure. It was like, yeah, I'm going to throw, you know, car chases and diamond heists and, you know, souped up 74 Plymouth Dusters and everything I loved growing up as a kid into this book. And I was very, very shocked that people connected with it the way they did. Yeah. But then after Razor Blade, I felt a ton of pressure. But now I've kind of let go of that a little bit. Now I'm just enjoying telling stories.
Well, where did that courage come from? Like, you know, when you're back working at the hardware store and doing day to day and you're writing and things aren't really selling and you're kind of working all these years, probably in your 40s, I guess. And all of us, where does that, because I call it courage. It's a courage to keep on doing it. It's a courage to keep on putting it out there for people to reject and to put down, right? I mean, because, you know, we all deal with it. And so it's a lot of courage, because every time you get slammed down and then you're going back into work and then some nasty customer wants this and that and you're having this, you go, oh my God, you know, what's wrong with me? And you know, so, but there must be something to keep that fire going, or there must be something that you feel was important to get your stuff out.
Yeah, the nasty customers is what kept me inspired. no, I, you know what I think it is, and it's going to sound really, I think, pretentious a little bit, but I just felt like writing was the one thing that I was really good at in my life. It was the one thing that came natural to me. Didn't come easy, but it came naturally to me. And I remember two instances when I was younger that inspired me to want to be a writer. One, when I was I think I was 9 or 10, I wrote this really long, rambling epic about elves that lived in the magnolia tree in my backyard. And I let my mom read it. And I'll never forget, she's passed on now, but I'll never forget the look on her face. You know, like, she was pleasantly surprised that it wasn't horrible. And that look on her face, man, it was like a high. I've been chasing it ever since, you know, because I realized that I had her interest and I had her curiosity all at the same time. I had her in the palm of my hand in a way, because I wrote that and she couldn't wait to finish the story. So that sort of kept me going. And then I had an 11th grade high school teacher, my English teacher, 11th grade, Jeff Bones. So shout out to Mr. Bones, who, after I had written a project for school, he pulled me aside. He said, hey, I want you to stay after class. I'm like, okay. I thought I was in trouble. And he said, I want to ask you, have you ever considered being a writer? Because you have a really unique voice. I'm like, oh, no. I just like telling stories. So he gave me two books. He gave me Shrunken White's Element of Style, and he gave me the collected work of Samuel Beckett. And he said, the first book will teach you how to write, and the second book will teach you why you write. And after reading both those books, I realized it's going to sound real corny, but I felt like this is what I'm put on earth to do. This is the thing that gives me, up to the time, you know, I met, you know, the love of my life, this is the thing that gave me the most pleasure in life, is writing. And even now, when I'm down, when I've had tough times, and I've had some tough times the last couple of years, with the great successes have been great. You know, I lost my mom, I lost my uncle, I've had some issues of my own, and it's like, writing has always been that thing that was able to buoy me, that able to bring me out of the morass, so to speak. And so I guess for me, to give you a succinct answer, because I tend to ramble, I'm sorry. But for me, I just always felt like this is what I'm put on earth to do. You know, birds got to sing and bees got to sting and I got to write. And so I just was too dumb or too stubborn to give up.
I remember I read something you posted on Facebook. It was an essay that was really wonderful. It was about being a Southern writer. And it was very striking. Mm-hmm. This was a year or two ago. So I was curious if you could speak to that specifically and how important that is to you and what that means.
Yeah, I think there are people who exist in this sort of bubble. that think the only writers from the South are, you know, neo-Confederate Southern apologists. And nothing could be further from the truth. You know, the South is a rich panoply of cultures and peoples and subcultures. And as an African-American man from the South, I feel like it's sort of partly my duty, partly my birthright to write about the South. You know, there's no place more afraid of its past and more confused by its future than the South. And I love where I come from. I love being a Southerner. I think Southern pride is not, you know, the battle flag of a 4-year hissy fit. Southern pride is a deep, abiding understanding of the natural world, of the mix of culture, the like I said, the underpinnings of Southern society, which is race, religion, class. All those things create what I like to call the true Southern culture, true Southern heritage. And it's something that I share with anybody who's born, you know, south of Maryland. If I go to a Southerner and I say the word scrapple,
yeah,
or I say sun tea, or I say, if I say we're going skink hunting, they know what I'm talking about, because that's almost like a shorthand. And I love that. I love having that sort of connection with people. At the same time, I'll paraphrase James Baldwin. Because I love the South, I feel like I have the right to criticize her unequivocally, because I think it can be a better version of what it is now. I want it to be the best version of what it can be. I want it to be the best version of what it can be. And so I take great pride in being a Southern writer. I take great pride in being a part of a long, long tradition. And, you know, it is something that I take very seriously. You know, when I first started writing, and I first started sending stories out, there were editors who were like, yeah, this is great, but can you change the setting to Chicago? And instead of making them down on their luck, ex-race car drivers, or down on their luck farmers, can you make them drug dealers? And, well, that's not my reality. That's not who I am. That's not the people I grew up with. That's not my uncles and my cousins and my grandma and them, you know? And so it's, like I said, an honor and a duty to talk and tell these stories and tell the stories, like I said, of the men and women that I grew up with, men and women, you know, who worked their whole lives just to enjoy a few moments of peace. So it's really important to me.
And also you were talking about how much you love hiking and being where you are in rural Virginia. You evoked a sort of mystic feeling. Like, I have to imagine it's also very physically beautiful where you are.
Oh yeah. It's lovely. I mean, I have friends in New York City who are very dear to me, and they're always like, when are y'all gonna move up here? Are y'all going to leave Virginia? And I'm like, I'm never going to leave Virginia. I love New York City. I love visiting. I love, like, going to the Village. I love going uptown. I love being, you know, going down to, like, you know, Battery Park and stuff like that. I really love the bars in New York City. But but there's something I'm connected to the natural world here in Virginia, you know? Like, right, I can get up in the morning and look out my back window, and there's a family of wild turkeys that live in our backyard. You know, there's a group of squirrels that I feed to the consternation of my neighbors. And so I'm very connected to that. I posted a thread early this year on Twitter about rural writers. Writers come from rural backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, so because somebody asked me, why is it that rural writing seems so brutal? And I said, you know, if you grew up in the South like I did, and you grew up poor in the South, you know, you grew up skinning deers and you know, skinning rabbits and having to chop wood for a wood stove, not as an affectation, but to survive, then you have a very deep connection to the natural world. And there's a very thin veil between life and death in the natural world. There's a writer named Laura McHugh, I think I'm saying her name right, who wrote a book this year called What's Done in Darkness. And she had a great line. She's like, you know, when you grow up poor in the South, you know, chopping wood is an exercise. It's either you chop wood or you freeze to death. You know, death is always around you as a writer from a rural area, whether it's rural Arkansas or whether it's rural North Carolina. And so there is sort of this mystic, quasi-supernatural feeling that exists in the South, you know, and I'm definitely a part of that, and I definitely embrace it. I have a good friend, the writer Jordan Harper, who wrote She Rides Shotgun, one of the great crime novels of the last 20 years. And he and I were talking, because he's originally from the Ozarks. He's from Missouri, but he's lived in L.A. for a number of years. And he was talking about how we have a different sensibility when it comes to writing. He has embraced sort of a nihilistic viewpoint, a more James Ellery-esque, Elroy-esque sort of idea that everything's bad and only a few people that try to swim against the tide, even those people get overwhelmed. Mm. Where I still am steeped in traditional Southern Baptist mythology that, you know, I've never seen the righteous forsaken. And so even though they have to go through a lot, my characters usually come out on top. They suffer and they pay for that victory in blood, in sometimes buckets of blood, but they usually come out on top. And I think it's fascinating because I admire him so much. And so to be able to talk with someone that I admire about the differences, but that doesn't make, I think, one of us better than the other. I think it's just a different way we approach the craft and the way we approach narrative. I love talking about that, you know. So
yeah, is there a so are you implying you more or less said it, but don't let me put words in your mouth. Is there's a spiritual component to what you're describing in terms of like the veil between life and death and the nearer supernatural state of where you are? So talk more about that.
Yeah. So like, I haven't really delved into it in my first two books. But I'm working on something now that really sort of encompasses that. But I think even in Raised by Tears, when the fathers go to the graveyard to talk to their sons, or there's this idea that they're on a mission. They never explicitly say they're on a mission from God, but they're on a mission for revenge. And I think if you read that book, the spirits of their sons follow them throughout their bloody path of rage. I'm maybe what you would call an agnostic person. I was raised in Southern Baptist Church. I've kind of moved away from it. I think organized religion is the bane of our existence, but at the same time, I think spirituality is whatever keeps you going. Whatever you think is beyond, you know, the real that you see in front of you, that can be spirituality. It doesn't have to be a Christian dogma, but whatever you take that helps you keep floating, especially like you've seen the last couple of years with the pandemic and everything that's happened, whatever keeps you alive, whatever keeps you going is your spirituality. And so I'm sort of delving more into that now. Like with Bug in Blacktop Wasteland, he has a spiritual connection to that car. You know, that car talks to him in a way, you know? And that was intentional. I very much wanted to sort of give that car its own personality and have their connection be quasi, I don't say quasi supernatural, but right, it goes right up to the line of supernatural, but doesn't go across it.
So when you're dealing with, you know, let's say pain or despair or feelings, when you start talking about the last couple of years, not only in the U.S., the world and politics and just everything going on, then you've got your own issues to deal with and stuff. Mm-hmm. How do you, I don't know, what's the way to say this? How do you do it in your writing and yet not get depressed or, you know, not get really down? Like, you know, because you've got to feel a lot of what you're writing.
Oh, yeah. I think for me, the writing is the thing that keeps me up. Like, in my writing, a lot of times bad guys get their comeuppance, and that really happens in real life. And so that, I mean, it sounds awful to say that, but that gives me so much joy. You know, it gives me, you know, so much joy to see a bad guy get their just desserts in my fiction. But also I feel like I heard Alan Moore say something. I didn't take the master class, but a friend of mine did. He shared this clip with me where Alan Moore said, you know, take it seriously that you are a magic maker. You know, that we've been telling stories to each other since people started gathering around campfires. It's a serious thing that a lot of people don't take seriously. But when the pandemic happened, what did people turn to for solace? Books, stories, whether it was on TV, whether it was on your Audible, whether it was on your Kindle, you look toward the imagineers, the imagination makers to help you through it. And I felt like I helped myself through it. Now, granted, some of the stuff I wrote during the pandemic was very dark. And so, but it helped me kind of excise those feelings. I have some of that stuff was, ooh, you had to go like, wow.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's a cartoon afterwards, but it helped me get through those feelings, my own feelings of depression, my own feelings. I'm a very extroverted person, so the pandemic, especially the early days, was just awful for me. It was horrible. I feed off the energy of the people. I love being around people. Anybody who's ever been with me at a convention can tell you I love posting up in the bar and just talking about writing, talking about books that I've read, and talking about the idea and the craft of writing. So not being able to see my friends, my family, it was hell. Unequivocally, I'll say that. And writing helped keep me sane through that. And so those, like you said, those moments when I'm down and depressed and sad, writing has kept buoying me. You know, like, I lost my mom last March to complications from COVID, and she had other health problems. She had been ill for quite a long time. And, you know, the thing that helped me through that in a way was that she lived long enough to see some of this happen, you know, to see some of the success, I guess you want to call it, happen for us. Because we were very poor growing up. My mom and dad separated when I was young, and my mother had several debilitating physical ailments. And so it was hard for us. We just, you know, we didn't have a lot of money and we lived in a single wide trailer in the middle of the woods. And, you know, but she always prioritized educating yourself, whether it was going to school or reading books. She was a voracious reader. I took that from her. And so the way I dealt with her passing was to know that she got to see my name on the cover of a book published by Macmillan Publishing. And I mean, if that doesn't help put a smile on your face, nothing will.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So what is your process then? Like, how does Sean write a book? Like, do you do it 9 to 5, 5 days a week? And can you just sit down and write? Or do you have to be in the mood? Like, what goes on with you, especially with these feelings and moods? So you're having a hard day and a rough day and all that. Can you just still turn it on and write? Or does it have to be the right timing?
Well, the first thing I do is I go in the woods and I dig a hole in the ground and I plead for, no, just playing. I think for me, that work ethic that I grew up with is, writing is the most fun, easiest job I've ever had. So I worked a lot of physical jobs before. Before I was working at a hardware store, I was a landscaper, I was a boatmate, I was a bouncer, you know, I was a brick mason. And so I don't wait for inspiration, especially now, because I feel like, you know, I owe people these books. I owe people these stories. So, like, right now I'm working on a book, and I write every day when I'm working on the book. I try to write early in the morning. When I was younger, I used to write late at night. I felt like my creative juices were flowing more at night. But as I've gotten older, I've gotten tired, so I try to write early in the morning. I try to write two hours in the morning, take a break, write a couple more hours. And then if I'm feeling really in the groove, I'll write a few more hours. But I try not to overdo it, because then I think you lose the narrative. Before I start a book, I write a pretty long detailed synopsis to myself. It's very much like a stream of consciousness. Just it's almost like a storyboard. I'm just telling myself the story idea, you know, And then once I've done that, I use that sort of as a roadmap to write the book. A lot of times that synopsis in the book are very different, but it just gives me a guide as to where I want to go with the story, what story beats I want to hit, what, you know, themes, both textual and subtextual, I want to talk about. And then once I get into it, like I said, I'm writing every day until the book is done. And once the book, once the book is done, what I'll usually do is send it to a few trusted friends. I don't really want to call them beta readers, but they're just friends of mine that are writers themselves that I really, really trust their opinions. And I just want to get back their impressions. I don't really get notes. I just want to say, how does this make you feel? What did you think? Did you think the pacing worked? Did you like the character? Did you like the main character? Do you feel like I hit the points I want to hit? And then after I do that, I kind of work on it a little bit more. And then I send it to my editor at Flatiron, a great person by the name of Christine Koprasch, who's really helped make me a better writer. And then she has it for about a month, and then she sends it back, and it looks like a murder scene because it's so much red. And then, and then after that, I kind of use her notes and her suggestions and go through it. And sometimes I take her notes and suggestions just whole cloth, and sometimes we debate about them, we talk about them. We have a really good working relationship and friendship. So she never tries to steer me wrong. There's just sometimes things that I feel are pretty passionate about, and then other times there are things like, you got to pick what hills you want to fight on, and not everything is worth fighting for. And once I do that, I send it back to her. We let it sit for a little while, and then we send it out. So that's pretty much the process. It may sound simple, but you know, anybody who's ever written knows it's, you know, you can stare at the screen for 30 minutes trying to decide the right word for the right sentence in the rhythm of the paragraph you're writing. That's the beauty of writing and the horror of it. So.
Yeah, you also said, you said earlier, after the success of Razorblade Tears, sort of that moment of feeling not necessarily stuck, but like, you know, you feel like you have to outdo yourself or you have to match it. And your friend said, no, just make sure it's good. Do you feel that all three novels that exist so far all hold the same bar, like they're at your own self-prescribed level of greatness or excellence?
I think Darkest Prayer is not a terrible novel, but it's not my best. It's not me at my best.
Okay.
You know, I was still finding my way. I was still sort of figuring out my voice. But you know, it's funny, even in saying that, there are lines in that book that I feel like are pretty damn good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think you have to feel that a little bit if you want to write. But yeah, there are things I actually had the opportunity to go back and change some things because my parent publisher, Flatiron, is reissuing that book this fall. And so I got to go through and do an edit where I could change some things. And, you know, you can only shine up the turd so much, but I was able to change some things and adjust some things. I think it's a much better book now. That being said, I think it's not quite as good as Blacktop and Razorblade. And those two are neck and neck. I felt like with Blacktop,
is it the fact that that Blacktop and Razorblade are more personal? Is that what makes the difference?
I think so, especially with Blacktop. I mean, Blacktop is very cathartic. It's me talking about me and my dad. It's me talking about me and my mom. It's me talking about growing up poor in the South as a black man. It's a very, you know, personal book for me. You know, if you squeeze that book too tight, you know, you'll see blood come out because I bled all over the pages. But I think with Razorblade, like I felt when I wrote Blacktop, I felt like I'd never be able to outdo it. I just, you know, again, to quote Bruce Springsteen, I put everything I had into that book. Everything. I mean, I just shoved it full of everything that I thought made me a good writer. And I never thought I would best that book, you know? And there are lines in that book I don't think I'll ever match. You know, and that sounds sort of egotistical, but I, you know, just to be honest, I think there are moments in that book that are so fully realized. So when I wrote Razorblade, because I'm tackling something that actually is a little less personal, I felt like I've got to really push myself even harder to make it match Blacktop. And by the end of it, I felt like, yeah, I think I did. I think I did. You know, ultimately readers decided, you know, that they like both books. And so now with the book I'm working on now, it's even more so. I've got to push myself to match those two books. What, like I said, doesn't have to be better. It has to be That's good.
How do you, I know it's a tough thing to quantify, it's elusive, but what are you looking for if you could quantify it? Is it the feeling of emotional excitement that it just packs that sort of punch?
No, I think what I look for with my own writing, when I feel like I'm really done something well, when I really feel like I've achieved my aims, is I want people to read the book and feel a deep connection to the characters, the main characters.
Okay.
You don't even have to like them. I just want you to connect with them. You know, I want you to understand what they're feeling. I want you to feel their pain. You know, pain is universal. And so I want you to feel that. If I'm reading the book and I feel like I feel the pain, then I feel like, yeah, a reader is going to, you know, someone else is going to read it and feel the same thing. That's when I feel like I really have succeeded at what I'm trying to do. Because for me, plot is interchangeable. You know, there's only so many plots, but there's an infinite number of characters or different types of characters. And so for me, the characters are the basis of the book. You know, Ike and Buddy Lee are the foundation of Razor Blade. Bug is the foundation of Blacktop. You know, really, to be honest, Blacktop is sort of a cliche setting. You know, it's a former criminal doing the one last job sort of trope. But, you know, it's a variation on a theme, you know, and I think it's the variation. It's in those spaces of that variation where you find the story. Jack London said one time, he said, I'm not much on original plot, but I'm a hell of an elaborator. And I try to take that as my guiding light.
Did you stay in the first person after that first novel?
No, I went to third person with Blacktop and with Razor Blade and with the book I'm working on now. And I think first person is really good for me as a writer, for anything that's going to be PI adjacent, private eye adjacent. I think first person really works for that because you can hide clues from the reader easier. I'm finding that out because the book I'm working on now is more of a traditional mystery than, say, Razor Blade or Blacktop. But I think also, this is sort of weird, but first person can feel very personal.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It can feel very intimate. And so I didn't want to get that intimate with the books I'm working on now because they're heavy books, man. You know, for all the violence and stuff, Darkest Prayer is a pretty fun book. It's an adventure, so to speak. With Blacktop and with Razor Blade, they're both heavy themes. You know, Blacktop is generational trauma, you know, and poverty and racism. Razor Blade is, you know, homophobia and prejudice and, you know, classism and violence and the high price of redemption. And the book I'm working on now is, you know, a Southern Gothic murder mystery, but it's also about guilt and it's about how we process trauma and how that, you know, shapes us and forms us and makes us different than maybe who we were before that trauma. So they're heavy books, man. So I would like to write another first person book. I really like to write another book with the characters from Darkest Prayer because I love those guys. There's a lovable sociopath in that book. So, you know, they're fun characters to write. I mean, and it's like be a nice break from the sort of more very deep sort of heavy stuff that I write currently.
Everything thus far sounds like if there's a genre classification that's convenient, it would be crime. But in the meantime, the way you're describing it psychologically and thematically, it sounds literary. So how is there a way that you classify it or you don't bother with that?
Oh man, I have a friend. I'm not gonna say who it is because I don't want to get him in trouble. But we were talking about the literary versus crime, literary versus genre, and he said, "You know what? Literary fiction is just 300 pages of people talking about doing something."
Yeah,
he said, "Crime fiction is 300 pages about people dealing with what they've done."
Right,
and I would much rather deal with what the characters have done than talk about the potentiality, the potential kinetic energy. That's not my strong suit. There are writers who do it well. There are writers that I admire who do it well. You know, Jonathan Franzen, Jane Smiley, Alison Gitskill, people who really take that literary mantle and run with it. That's not really my thing. That's not my jam, but I'm not opposed to it. I think people like to call my writing literary crime. Somebody tried to say, yeah, you're writing in the same vein as Cormac McCarthy. First of all, do not tell that lie. Because Cormac McCarthy is up there, man. If there's a ladder, I'm on the bottom rung, and he's standing above me on the house. He's already off the ladder, so don't get yourself telling that lie. But I do understand the sensibility because I do use violence as a tool to show character, you know? And I think that's something we all had stolen from him. You know, I think any writer worth their salt that has ever read, you know, No Country for Old Men or, any of his Southern Gothic novels or The Road, or even, you know, Blood Meridian, you've stolen that idea that violence reveals character. I think, you know, the idea to call him myself literary, you know, I feel like call it what you want. I just want to tell good story.
How important is the element of suspense to you? And that question crossed my mind just based on you saying dealing with what you've done. So is that a driving component of your writing, just keeping that tension?
Oh, yeah. I think suspense is, you know, it's this sort of dance between what you know, what the reader knows, and what the characters know.
Yeah.
And it's like you're juggling all three of those things at the same time. And when it works, you know, it gets characters' hearts. I mean, it gets readers' hearts beating, you know. There's a scene in Razorblade where a character does something foolish. And I fully admit it is foolish. A character is told that their house is on fire. And they know that bad guys are looking for them. But they got to go back to the house because, you know, their son's baby shoes are there. And it's the only thing they have left of them. And another character tells him, hey, you can't go. This is so obviously a trap. We can't go. And that character's like, I don't care. You know, if there's even a glimmer that it's true, I got to go and get these baby shoes. And that other character goes with them. And so everybody that's reading that scene knows it's a trap, right? But the trick is to get the reader to be that other character. Like, all right, I'm going along with you. I know it's a trap. Let's see what the hell happens. And once you get there, then it's your job as a writer to really come at them from left field. You got to make it seem like, oh, maybe it's not a trap. Maybe there's something, everything's okay. No, everything's not okay. Run for your life. And so I think that sensibility is something that I love evoking in my stories. I love that sense of that undiscovered country between terror and suspense. I love doing that, you know.
Yeah.
It's like to use that example even further, when that happens, another character is calling those characters on the cell phone. He's trying to get to them because he can't get to them because there's been an accident on the road and it's the only road in and out of this location. And so because they don't answer the phone, he keeps calling back. And keeps not getting an answer. And so you just turn those screws. You keep ratcheting up that tension. And of course, tension is like, you know, suspense is like lust. At some point, there's got to be a payoff, right? And so you got to do your best as a writer to make sure that payoff, that you honor the people who went along with you on that suspenseful ride, that the payoff matches the level of suspense that you created.
Mm. Do you foresee a long body of work? Do you think in those terms? Like, do you want a new book every year or two? And in the end, there's a library of 40, or are you thinking, okay, I'm going to do 5 masterpieces, then I'm done? Where's your mind around that?
I tell you what, man, when you say it like that, it does make you think of, I think I would love to have like an, oh God, I can't believe I'm man. As a kid said, I can't believe I'm going to manifest this, but I'd love to have an Elmore Leonard career where I just put out a couple books every couple of years.
Yeah.
They don't always have to be that solid, but they're interesting and fun and different and unique enough that people will find them and search them out. I don't know. I think it does get harder, like every time you write a new book, because again, you're competing against yourself. I never feel like I'm competing against other writers. I really don't. I'm always competing against the ghost of myself, the past versions of F.A. Cosby. And so, you know, I don't want to ever get to where I'm competing so hard with myself that I become a parody of myself, you know?
Right.
But at the same time, I just can't imagine not writing. I love it right now so much. I can't imagine not even just doodling with short stories. I just love writing. So I don't even give it that much thought. I could see myself doing the Lee Child thing. Hey, I'm 68. I'm done. I retire. But also I could see myself doing, you know, the Stephen King thing. Hey, I'm 75 and here's another book. I wrote 3 while you were taking a nap. So, you know.
You got to play it as a blaze. Just see. It's almost like too much to think about at once. You have to see with each new book your level of excitement and then the where you're at in terms of your career and the responsiveness and how the whole the whole saga unfolds.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely, definitely.
So where do you see yourself going now?
I have some really cool opportunities that have come up. Again, everything that's happening in the last few years is so far beyond anything I ever dreamed that it beggars itself to be a surreal. You know, I have done some really cool things. I wrote an 8-episode audio drama for Audible for Kevin Hart's production company. That was in Variety a couple months ago, so hopefully that'll be coming out soon. That was a great opportunity. Doing that sort of gave me the confidence to maybe one day tackle a screenplay, because it's basically a screenplay, it's just an audio screenplay. But in many ways, it was a lot easier to write in a book because, you know, when you write a book, for me anyway, I always do a lot of details, you know, what the weather felt like, what the trees looked like, how the characters are thinking, so on and so forth. When you write a screenplay, you got to do that. It's all dialogue, you know. And I'm really bad at spatial relations. I like to tell people, if you built a house based on the way I describe them in my books, it'd be 87 feet long and 9 feet wide. So it's like, when you do a screenplay, you ain't got to do any of that. So maybe I might be working on a screenplay soon. I've had talks with some folks about maybe working on some comic book related stuff. I did a really cool collaboration I can't talk about it yet. I'm waiting. Oh my God, we're so close to announcing it. It's driving me crazy. But I did a really cool, like middle grade, young adult type novel with a really interesting person that I can't say who it is. and so that opportunity was great. That was incredibly fun. Like I said, I'm working on something right now, tentatively titled All the Sinners Bleed, a Southern Gothic murder mystery. I'll give you the elevator pitch real quick. So basically, it's about the first black sheriff in a small southern town named Titus Crown. And on the 1-year anniversary of his election, there's a shooting at the local high school. A beloved science teacher is killed by a former student, and that student is in turn killed by Titus's deputies. In investigating the crime, he finds out that the school teacher, the student, and a third mystery person were involved in serial killings. They were a trio of serial killers.
Wow.
And Titus is trying to find who the third person is, while at the same time dealing with a sort of neo-Confederate far-right group that wants to hold a march during his town's, like, you know, annual fall fest, and they want to march in support of the town's one, and I do it as a joke, very ugly Confederate statue. And so he's got that going on while he's trying to find his serial killer, and he has his own secrets from his inauspicious resignation from the FBI years ago. So it's been fun writing it. It took a lot of influence from, like, True Detective season one. And so it's really me, I think, for the first time, really embracing, like I said, just my ideas of spirituality, religion, both the positive and negative aspects of it. You know, I think it was Malcolm X that said, there's no place more segregated in America than church on Sunday morning. And so I sort of want to talk about those issues and those things and how those things relate, especially in a small town. You know, in doing research for this, I grew up in a small town. I grew up in a town of 8,000 people. And I was like, as a kid, I remembered there was a lot of churches there. But I said, let me see how many actually are in that town. So I looked up my hometown and an online almanac. A town of 8,000 people has 27 churches. And I thought that was such an interesting commentary about Southern life, about how we all want to get right with God, but I don't think you're right enough. So I'm going to go over here to this church. I'm going to go over here and found that church. And it's ultimately hypocrisy because, you know, I think it was Flannery O'Connor that said, you know, I don't know if the South is Christ-centered, but it's definitely Christ-haunted. And it's haunted by the hypocrisy because nothing is less Christ-like than judging people by the color of their skin. So, yeah. So again, you know, my usual light family fare.
Yeah.
That I like to
talk about. Also, the one component we didn't mention also that's really running strong through all your work is it's socially conscious. It's very also intersected with the zeitgeist in addition to being very personal to you. So that's a really strong combination.
Oh, man, yeah. I mean, I think all fiction is like that, though. I think, you know, there are fiction that is just popcorn fiction. Like,
right, right.
I don't know if you're ever familiar, but there used to be a series of book called The Executioner, the Mac Boleyn series.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
they're
yeah.
Like okay. American yeah. James Bond. Yeah, and those books are just fun books. I read all those books when I was a kid. Like, they're just fun books. Mac goes into a small town and or a different country and kills a bunch of people and, you know, beds the hottest woman in the story and comes back home and, you know, lights up a lucky strike and sips a whiskey and goes on to the next mission. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, there's no social commentary in those books, and there doesn't need to be. You know, sometimes you just want to laugh. Sometimes you just want to be on the edge of your seat. But I think for me as a writer and a person, I wouldn't be the full version of myself if I didn't tackle some things that I found important. But I don't ever do it with a heavy hand. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody wants a 300-page sermon. Right. You know, so you get a little, like, I think it's Mary Poppins that said, you get a little honey to make the medicine go down. So, you know, come for the ritualistic serial murder, the state of the social comedy.
Right.
So now let's talk about how people can find you and call your names and all that sort of stuff. Do you like social media, websites, you know, hookup apps, like whatever you want to give up?
I need to get a social media presence more. I need a website. But if you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter a lot at BlackLionKing73, where I post weird observations, and I get into spats with older writers about whether or not there's enough white guys publishing. That's the whole thing. You know,
go to Twitter. We're not going to touch that. Patterson's lined. You know, he's lined up to be on the show, and it's like,
oh yeah,
and we're sort of in this hold now because he goes on BBC before us and starts going off.
Yeah, it literally happened a week before he was supposed to be on. I was supposed to co-host. Then now he's in the middle of that battle.
You know? Yeah, and then of course, you know, the agency's already said to me, "Well, you guys are not going to talk about this, are you?"
Right. What are you saying?
But no, in all seriousness, I'm on Twitter a lot. Look for me at BlackLionKing73. You can find me on Instagram and on Facebook. I will soon get a website. I have to. I love hearing from people. I get the greatest emails from folks. Nice emails and weird ones. I get very interesting emails sometimes, but mostly are nice ones. I love hearing that people read my books and enjoy them. You know, I think I took a lot of inspiration from Stephen King, not only stylistically, but, you know, he used to always have this thing in front of his books where he wrote to the constant reader, you know, and he thanked them for reading his books. And I feel like that. I want to thank people for reading my books. I want to thank people for reading my stories, you know, because like I said, I've had a lot of jobs and I've only been good at one, you know, and it's the thing that makes me most happy. It's the thing that brings me most joy. I never, ever take any of this for granted. My mom used to say, you know, the shine wears off the new pennies quick.
Yeah.
And so you've got to enjoy it while it lasts, you know? And for me, part of enjoying it is, you know, shouting up my friends that have books coming out, talking to readers about my books. I love doing book club things with Zoom, you know, when we all became experts at Zoom. So I had a lot more opportunities to do book club meetings. And I love it because nobody is as passionate about your book as a book club. And so, you know, and sometimes they yell at you. You know, I had a lot of people yell at me about the ending of Raised by Tears. And that's fun, you know. And but yeah, it's just a magical world, man. Yeah. You know, and I can't believe I get to do this for a living.
Yeah. Well, you know, we appreciate you being on the show, and I'm going to have to look up that Stephen King guy. I think
he comes up a lot.
Yeah, I keep hearing about this guy, and I've still yet to read one of his books. So
it sounds pretty good.
He's got a great career ahead of him.
Yeah, you know? He might do okay, but I hear it's really tough for white guys right now. So I don't know.
No. All they have to do is just take that one clip of your voice, Al. That's all.
Yeah, I know. It's just like I had to do it. I'm sorry. Well, it's been a pleasure. And so our guest has been the one and only Sean Cosby. So thank you for being on the show.
Man, thank you guys so much for having me. This was a blast. I really had a great time.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.